It's Let's Talk Legal on the Talk Station, FM 107.1. And joining us today, of course, Cecil Harvell of Harvell and Collins. And with that, Cecil, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Lockwood. I hope you're doing well on a hot summer day.
Yes, the dog days of summer.
Yes. Is that what what we used to call them?
Right.
Even the dogs don't like these days.
No, they don't.
My Labrador, and I know other people can relate to this.
Oh my goodness.
My Labrador, I open the door and I say, "Come on, let's go outside." He sniffs around a little bit and says, "No, thank you."
That just goes to show dogs sometimes have better sense than we humans. But anyhow.
Yeah, it's interesting. All right, Lockwood. Look, we at Harvell and Collins, certainly one of our, if you will, concentrations in the law is the area of trust and estate.
Mm-hmm.
And as a trust lawyer, I would like to talk this morning about some of the, if you will, kind of demystify the issue of trust. There's a lot of confusion, Lockwood, with it. It begins with just that there are so many different types of trust. Some people will make an appointment and even over the telephone say, "Well, I'm coming in to see Mr. Harvell because I understand he can prepare a well-drafted trust agreement." And that's just fine. But then we have to get back in the conference room and kind of, you know, the devil is in the detail.
Mm-hmm.
So let me say this, Lockwood. You know, I have to have, as a good lawyer, I need something to hang my hat on
right. In
order to justify creating a trust agreement. Now, let's begin by just saying a trust agreement is just that. It's an agreement between the creator of the trust mm-hmm. and the trustee of the trust who would handle the affairs for the benefit of the beneficiary. So there are three parties to any trust agreement. There's the person who creates the trust. There's the trustee who is responsible for managing the trust assets. And then there, of course, are the beneficiaries. But the bottom line is that there needs to be a purpose. What is the purpose of having a trust prepared for our clients? What is that purpose? So let's go through some of those, Lockwood, some of the things, some of the prongs, if you will, where I as a trust lawyer can kind of hang my hat and feel comfortable in taking a client down the road of preparing a trust agreement. Now, one of the ones right out of the gate, which is very easy to understand, is a trust for minor children.
Mm-hmm.
So if we have a younger couple, middle-aged couple, even in our office, and they have, you know, children that range from, you know, birth age all the way up to, you know, 15 or 16 years old, and mom and dad go on a trip and don't come back, God forbid,
mm-hmm.
there has to be an organization whereby the assets of that family go into a trust for the benefit of the minor children. So immediately if in the consultation clients begin to tell me that they have minor children that are under the age of 18, or even maybe they might be a little bit older than that, but they still desire a trust, the bottom line is that certainly is a good reason for a trust instrument to be prepared to protect minor children.
Cecil, I want to interrupt here very quickly and just remind folks, of course, number one, we're listening to Cecil Harvell of Harvell and Collins, and I want to remind you also you can reach out to Cecil and the staff. Wes Collins joins us many times as well at 252 area code 726-9050. The other reason I want to interrupt on this on your behalf, Cecil, you've said this on numerous occasions, and there have been instances where we've talked about trust in estates as well in relationship to taxes that also management of estates following the death of a principal, that you don't just randomly throw in the concept of a trust, that you have specifically said on numerous occasions that you create a trust when there's a justification for it. It's not just for you, it's just not a business transaction. You want to look for the benefit of the client. And I just want to make comment on that. This reiterates what you've said many times before about the value and the importance of trust. So I apologize for interrupting, but I wanted to at least give you credit for, you know, constantly harping, or I shouldn't say harping, but being focused on that. Everything you do with intention, with significant purpose. I apologize.
That's right, Lockwood, and I appreciate so much you remembering that. Now, speaking of children, sometimes, though, we have a little bit of a twist here where the children maybe are of majority age. I mean, they may even be 30, 35, 40, 45 years old. But the client, for whatever reason, does not think that their child can manage their third of the inheritance or half of the inheritance or even all if they are a single child. So there are times that clients bring facts to the table. I call it the pieces of the puzzle, whereby they're explaining to me as their lawyer that, well, yes, my daughter is, you know, 35 years old, but I'm not going to be able to trust her with my inheritance at this point. It needs to be in a trust. My brother or my sister needs to, meaning her aunt or uncle, needs to be the trustee and give it out to her in installments over the course of 35, 40, 45, because she's just simply going to be, or he is simply going to be, unable to handle that kind of inheritance. Twist on these facts, Lockwood, can be that there's been, you know, sadly, alcoholism or drug addiction or drug issues or in and out of rehabilitation centers, things of that nature. You know, these are the facts that we as lawyers confidentially hear from our client.
Right.
So another purpose, another reason to create a trust is because the client's child is just simply, in the opinion of the client, is unable to handle their assets. A permutation on these facts is that, well, I think my daughter is able to handle the assets of the inheritance, but I don't trust her husband.
Right.
Or or my son is just wonderful, but I don't trust his wife. And what if I allow the inheritance to go to the husband, and then they have a divorce, and my wife and his wife is in control of the assets to the exclusion of my grandchildren? So again, Lockwood, you begin to hear that we have to listen very carefully to the facts that are presented in the conference, and then we take the pieces of the puzzle, the facts of the client as they tell us the facts, and we then mold those facts into the proper document for the client. So children are a big motivation for estate planning, no question about that. But as you're beginning to hear, it can be that the child has issues, or it can be that the client is concerned about the in-law or the spouse of the child. So these are all good reasons to sit down and discuss these facts and circumstances with a good trust lawyer, and then the lawyer will align documents that satisfy these objectives.
You know, Cecil, wondering in that second scenario, there may be instances where, for, and I'm wondering if this has transpired, where the principal, we'll just use randomly now, the parent, the father, has a business that is very complicated and, of course, would like to see the business continue, but is concerned that the child or children really don't have a comprehension of the complexities of that business. So can the business be established and put into a trust to be operated independent of the children, but at the same time the children benefit from it, both directly as a result of profits and so forth, and should the company ever be sold, they would benefit from assuming a run-up in the value of that business. Is that one of those ways of establishing a trust and sort of for a business purpose?
Absolutely. We many times have closely held family businesses. It might be that one of the children is working significantly in the business.
Right.
The other two children don't even live in the area or in the state of North Carolina. We have facts and circumstances where a business working on a file right now where it's just understood that a particular child is going to take over the business, and there's an offset of assets otherwise in other areas of the file that would satisfy the two children that are not going to be involved in the business. So absolutely, sometimes the facts that are presented dictate that a trust be utilized to help manage a business, a closely held family business, anything of that nature. The same with maybe it's rental properties. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's the management of a farm, a family-held farm, or several farms. Maybe it's the management of the beach cottage that's been, you know, at Emerald Isle on the ocean front for, you know, 35 years. And now the client is interested in that being utilized for the children and the grandchildren for the next generations or so. And a trust, again, would be a vehicle that we could use that would help establish and meet some of those objectives.
We're talking with Cecil Harvell of Harvell & Collins. And again, that number, 252 area code, 726-9050, 726-9050, here on Let's Talk Legal. We're talking about trusts. And to reiterate our conversation earlier, and Cecil has said this on numerous occasions, he just doesn't willy-nilly build a trust or create a trust for a client. There's got to be justification, logical, beneficial justification for the client, for the beneficiaries of the trust.
So Lockwood, we've all heard the word the living trust. It's terribly overused, and clients will even in an appointment, in a telephone for their scheduling their appointment, say, I'm coming in to see Mr. Harvell because I've read something and we need a living trust. So, you know, let's talk about that because that's out there. Now, what happens in the world is that folks are out there selling, if you will, marketing these, quote, living trust packages. They come in and they offer lunches at Golden Corral and different places. There's nothing wrong with Golden Corral, by the way. But the bottom line is that they just, you know, as I like to express, willy-nilly place these folks into a living trust so as to, quote, avoid probate. And so let's talk about that, Lockwood. We live in North Carolina. Our state is going to be controlled by North Carolina law, and even specifically in one of these counties, but maybe possibly in eastern North Carolina, Craven, Jones, Pamlico, Onslow, New Hanover, Carteret County, where the clerk of court is ready to open up an estate literally within days, I mean 48, 72 hours of a date of a death. Okay, yes, we need a death certificate, but sometimes those come in very, very quickly. The bottom line is that there is not a delay in our state as to opening up a probate file, nor is there the onerous burdens that we have in other states like New York, New Jersey, Michigan, Illinois, California, usually in highly industrialized states, where the probate process is just burdensome as can be. So there's no need to just put blinders on and create a living trust unless there is really some very significant facts. Maybe there, for instance, maybe there are real properties in two or three different states. Maybe there are a multiplicity of different stocks and bonds, even stocks that are closely held, as we just discussed. Maybe there are assets that are unusual in nature, maybe even potentially, you know, a real property in the Bahamas or a real property in a foreign country. So we need to hear some very specific facts that would justify putting someone into a, quote, living trust other than just to, quote, avoid probate. Probate is not the dirty word, Lockwood, that it is in so many other states. There, of course, was the famous book, How to Avoid Probate, and I've read that book more than once, and it's got some good pointers in there. But again, when the facts fit, when there are a multiplicity of differing kinds of assets where there would be some burdensome activity if it were handled in the probate rather than a trust format. So let's don't just go into a living trust just for the benefit of saying we have a living trust. Let's make sure that our facts support that.
I like that comment, when the facts determine the value, the benefit, the absolute necessity. I have a quick question for you, Cecil. And again, Cecil Harvell of Harvell and Collins with us. And that number, by the way, just to remind you, 252 area code 726-9050 and online at harvellandcollins.com. Spell out the word and, harvellandcollins.com. Cecil, the term living trust, what does that mean?
Yeah. What does living is a slang, if you will, code word for the fact that it just is so simple that we sometimes miss it, Lockwood, that it's created while we are living.
Okay.
And we, while we are living, are the trustee of the trust.
Oh.
So it has this kind of living nature to it. We create it while we're still alive. We manage it while we're still alive. We go ahead and transfer our assets into it. But we are living and we are alive and we manage it. And it really doesn't take on any real form of significance until we, the living person, die. And then that trust would then go, you know, either collapses out to the wife or the children,
mm-hmm.
or maybe it lingers on for some reason. But the bottom line is, because we've created it while we're living, and because we're in charge of it, we're the trustee while we're living, the slang has occurred in the trust context that calls it a living trust. It also is known as a revocable trust, meaning that it can be changed at any time by the creator, by the living person. They can change the assets in it, they can change the terms, they can change who the trustee happens to be, and so it is also revocable in nature.
Okay, I've heard the term many times before, but all right, we're talking about the aspects of justification for a trust with Cecil Harvell of Harvell and Collins. All right, Cecil, in the process, very quickly, and then you've got more, I'm sure, I apologize, but very quickly, in the case of the benefactor of the trust, the creator of the trust, and they die, then you have to have, the devil's in the details. You have predetermined whether the trust will continue past death or, as you said a moment ago, will collapse. There's a lot of details. It's not a matter of just creating the trust. You've got to determine what you're going to do with it at the end of the trust, in other words.
That's right. That's all within the language of the trust agreement, the paragraphs, if you will, the wording that's in the trust, to bring it down to practical language as to, you know, upon my death, the following occurs. And maybe the trust simply goes out to my two loving children, 50-50, and that's the end of it. And they are of majority age, and so therefore there's no need to hold it back because they're not minors. And none of those other issues are prevalent, such as concern about in-laws and concern about spendthrift and concern about, you know, alcoholism or drug addiction or any of those issues, which are very, very unfortunate. Now, speaking of I don't know that I want to use the word unfortunate. It's just a reality, Lockwood, that we have special needs children, don't we? We have many incredible families who have a special needs child.
Mm-hmm.
And that special needs child, even though they are now 30 years old, 35 years old, they have to be provided for.
Right.
And we don't want them to inherit assets outright from the parent that then upsets, if you will, or disqualifies them from their Social Security disability or any other benefits that they happen to have. And so those particular clients would have what would be known as a special needs trust. And if any of our listeners out there have a special needs child, then trust me, Lockwood, they know exactly what I'm talking about, because at their support groups, and I have spoken at these support groups many, many times, at these special needs support groups for various families with special needs children, this idea, this planning tool, if you will, is very prevalent in their minds. And so obviously one of the clearest purposes of a trust would be a special needs trust that is for the benefit of a special needs child.
You know, I can also appreciate because associated with that, obviously, is the parents' concern what will happen after they depart the scene, to use the term euphemistically. And so by establishing these trusts, what they've done is they've gone into the future, if you will, and protected a loving member of the family, something of that nature.
That's right. That's exactly true. And again, though, we have to discuss with these clients who would be the trustee.
Right.
After the parents are no longer living, would it be the brother or the sister of the special needs child, if mm-hmm. they have that? Would it be an uncle or aunt? Would it be, you know, a friend or neighbor or cousin, if you will, a family member, maybe even distantly removed, but one that is trustworthy, that is maybe in the medical community, legal community, accounting community? These are the things that we hear from clients. Clients will say, well, we don't have a child, another child, but my brother has a daughter that is a medical doctor,
right,
or is, you know, a CPA, or you know, she would be great as a trustee for our special needs child. So we work through these things little by little, and we find a trustee that is the best fit that we can find under all the circumstances.
You know, talking to you about this, and again, we're talking with Cecil Harvell of Harvell & Collins, and I do want to remind you, available for consultation, and as you heard just a few moments ago, he's spoken to various groups, special needs particularly. That number, by the way, 252 area code, 726-9050, 726-9050. I go back to a comment you made at the opening of the program here, Cecil, about the issue of trust. The devil is in the details. So it's not just a matter of we're creating this instrument. You're concerned with the justification for it and then the conclusion of it, or, if you will, the ultimate goal.
Right. That's correct. And it's very important that the details of how the trust would be implemented at some point mm-hmm. are very specifically included in the language in the trust. Now, Lockwood, this next one, I like to call it kind of the twins. It's two sides of the same two sides of the same coin.
Uh-huh.
It used to be, when I started practicing law in the area of trust and estates, which was over 30 years ago, Lockwood, and you knew me 30 years ago. You remember me
yes,
as a young buck, okay, and I remember you as well. The bottom line is that all my clients, it seemed, were concerned about estate tax.
Mm-hmm.
Estate tax was $600,000, meaning any assets over and beyond $600,000 were taxed. And so that's where we were 30 years ago.
Right.
The exemption equivalent amount, if you will, was $600,000. And so many, many clients needed a trust so as to avoid this estate tax. The estate tax now, my friend Lockwood, is $11 million per person. So in other words, $22 million for a husband and a wife,
right,
okay, because they both are entitled to their $11 million. It's really actually a little bit more than $11 million.
Mm-hmm.
So the lay of the land has just dramatically changed relative to estate tax. It used to be, Lockwood, that almost every estate that we handled at Harvell & Collins, we had a little check, but believe it or not, sometimes a little bit bigger check, that went out to the U.S. Treasury, okay?
Right.
Practically every estate we handled had a little check that went out to the U.S. Treasury.
Mm-hmm.
I rarely see those checks anymore. Now, we have clients that have those net worths at our firm, but that is a lot of net worth.
It is.
You know, $22 million. So a client, a family would need to exceed those numbers in order to trigger a check to the U.S. Treasury.
Mm-hmm.
So the necessity of, again, the purpose of the program today is about where do we hang our hat. We're just not going to be hanging our hat a lot on the mitigate estate tax prong in files very much this day and time, because most folks are just not going to have that kind of net worth. So rather than, I want to go to the other side of the coin. So rather than planning to avoid estate tax, interestingly, the biggest threat now to an estate is the cost of long-term care at $8,000, $9,000, $10,000 a month, well over $100,000 or more a year. So rather than the threat being estate tax, which it was 30 years ago, the threat now to folks' estate, normal people, if you will, which I consider myself, by the way, to be a normal person, Lockwood, and I bet you are too,
right,
is long-term care. Long-term care. And so rather than protecting our estates with a trust for avoiding estate tax, we are protecting ourselves with a trust to protect our assets from the devastating consequences of long-term care. I like to kind of put these two together, Lockwood. I hope I'm making sense. I'm going to let you comment about it. And because of the historical nature of this, it used to be estate tax. We have evolved beyond that for most people, but we have not evolved beyond the issue of protecting our assets from a long-term care.
And this, of course, having to do with Medicare and the fact that you have some prohibitions. Am I correct on that?
Correct. That's right. Medicare, which everyone has access to at 65 or older, is a program that provides significant, medical insurance, if you will, but it does not cover long-term nursing facility. It will pay for a nursing facility, as many of our listeners know, for rehabilitation. If we break a hip or a shoulder or something and we're in the facility for physical therapy and there is a medical documentation that we would be returning home after we are rehabilitated, after we receive physical therapy. But the bottom line, if we are in a nursing facility and there's no hope of us returning home, we simply are there for long term, then Medicare is not going to pay for that.
Right.
Medicaid will pay for it, but we have to have the square pegs and the square holes, the round peg and the round holes, which we at Harvell and Collins guide clients through being able to do this planning, and it does involve the use of a trust.
Very interesting. Again, we're talking with Cecil Harvell of Harvell and Collins and the justification for trust, and we've gone through a litany of them as we're wrapping things up here, Cecil. That aspect of a trust, one thing I just want to make comment, then this is something that really requires a dedicated time to focus on. Am I correct on that?
Correct. That's correct.
So we're hearing all the reasons for them and for the reasons not for them, by the way. I do like that comment. We all get those emails and those notices in the mail saying you need to attend this function to hear about trust documents and the way to prepare them, when, in fact, before you even begin doing that, talk to a counselor like Cecil Harvell at Harvell and Collins and understand the justification for it. That's important. And the issue here of long-term care, Cecil, as we wrap it up, is something that, quite frankly, we all are going to be facing in some fashion or another.
That's correct. And there are just so many angles, if you will, Lockwood. There's so many planning tools that can, in fact, be utilized that will help families protect some of their assets from the devastating consequences of a long-term care stay. Most families are not concerned about 3 months, 6 months, maybe even a year. But let's say that we have a loved one that's lingering in a nursing facility for, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6, mm-hmm. 7, 8 years. That happens, Lockwood, and that can be absolutely devastating to their finances, much like estate tax used to be devastating to the finances of a decedent back when the estate tax was $600,000. Without planning, we could lose 55% of the estate. Those are just not the facts anymore. Again, $11 million per person. The biggest threat to an estate is the long-term care, and that needs to be planned around.
Cecil Harvell with Harvell and Collins. And again, that number, 252, area code 726-9050. Go online to their website, Harvell and, spell out the word and please, harvellandcollins.com. And with that, as we wrap things up on Let's Talk Legal, Cecil, thank you for your time. I appreciate it. Look forward to talking to you. Thank you.
See you next week, Lockwood.